They will, but in the short term, the Fed just decided they would not raise those rates. But that set up another set of worries. In North Carolina, economic growth has continued, but economist John Connaughton, keeper of the North Carolina Economic Forecast at UNC Charlotte, sees more unpredictability in what has been a volatile year. And while the state is expected to gain jobs, unemployment is also rising here. So just how healthy is the economy? We get a checkup this hour from Tim Quinlan and Stephen Billings. Tim Quinlan is a vice president and economist with Wells Fargo Securities. He provides analysis on the macro U.S. economy and major foreign economies. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
Nice to have you here. And Dr. Stephen Billings is associate professor of economics and co-director of the newly named Childress Klein Center for Real Estate in the Belk College of Business at UNC Charlotte, and urban economist. He focuses on microeconomic forces, conducting research on schools, neighborhoods, and crime, among many other things. Thank you for joining us as well. Welcome.
Mike, thanks for having me.
So given all of the gyrations in the market and the uncertainty throughout the world about things of war and pestilence and things like that, how would you characterize the state of the economy so far this year? Let's begin nationally, Tim.
Okay, so I think you've got to acknowledge that we started off on the wrong foot. You know, the first estimate of GDP in the first quarter actually came out negative, so the economy shrinking to start the year. And Janet Yellen and others at the Fed labeled that weakness in the first quarter with a word they got often repeated in the press, which was transitory. Turns out they were right. Subsequent revisions to the first quarter data ended up with a slightly positive first quarter number, and then we really kind of snapped back in the second quarter. But we're getting a little bit long in the tooth in terms of this expansion. We've been going now, and the economy turned in the summer of 2009. An average expansion lasts about 59 months. We're about 75 months into this one, so it's a long expansion. And I think we're showing some signs of age at this point.
What about locally, statewide, even right down to the street that we're on?
That's right. So I think the forecast in North Carolina is probably a little more favorable in the sense that we're seeing lots of kind of good activity in North Carolina. Cities like Charlotte and Raleigh are expected to grow tremendously over the next couple decades. So I think it is a little more favorable in the state.
Even though we've lagged the rest of we've lost more jobs and lagged the recovery?
That's right. I mean, originally North Carolina is kind of underperformed and has been kind of lagging. Mm-hmm. I just think the forecast kind of longer term is more favorable here. We have a lot of kind of good indicators in terms of we're an area that has, you know, nice amenities, fairly low costs, lots of good positive things in that way that should drive some mm-hmm. activity to come.
I'm a little concerned about what you said a second ago, Tim, because we don't follow the economy like you do. It's your job to follow the economy, and you just said that we're in a particularly long recovery. The average recovery is 59 months. We're 75 months into that, and that means, evidently, we're due for another recession.
Right. According to the calendar, it must be imminent.
And yes, and to a lot of people, they feel they never came out of the last one. So
that's right.
What will it be like?
Well, I can tell you when you went out into the economy in 2010 and 2011 and talked about how we're now, you know, 2 years into the recovery. And in 2012, you said the recovery is over. We're now a bigger economy than we were before the recession began. People wanted to throw a pie in your face because it's still they're still talking about the recession now.
Why?
I think because of the very, very slow pace of this thing. I mean, if you look at, you know, let's just take jobs, for example. Your peak-to-trough decline in employment nationwide was 8.7 million. It took until March of last year to get all of those jobs back. You know, today we're north of that number by 3.9 million. So we're finally, the labor market's firing on all full cylinders again. But
is that why this has been a long recovery, because it's been so slow?
I think so. I mean, to some extent, the weakness of the recovery favors a longer expansion. And it bears noting that these cycles have been getting longer over time. The longest cycle on record was 1992 to 2001. We had a 120 months, a 10-year span. That was the longest on record.
Well, now, the recession that we've just been through was particularly brutal, almost a Great Depression, and it would have been a depression had certain things not taken place to stave that off. So would the next one be that bad, or would it? Or was that a particularly extraordinary event?
That's exactly where I was going. So I think if you look to you, when you have a recession, it's typically caused by one of two things, either something getting really out of whack in the economy or some exogenous shock from the outside. You know, you can't predict the exogenous shocks, but in terms of what's gotten really out of whack in the domestic economy, it's hard to point to a lot of examples today. Household balance sheets are in much better shape than they were before the last recession. Corporate balance sheets are in much better shape. We're all, you know, kind of better insulated against the big downdraft.
But our personal balance sheets better off than they were.
So I think one thing, one of the reasons people don't feel like we've recovered that much is the wage growth story. We've seen wage growth has been very kind of low. Even if even real wage growth is about 2% annually is what we're seeing. Regularly before this big recession, we saw about 4%. So we're, in general, people aren't seeing more money in their pockets. They're not seeing that wage growth, even though we're seeing this unemployment number go down. And so I think that really makes people feel like, well, are we really doing better off? I don't feel like I'm doing that much better. Mm.
If you watch the news, and people do, and we live in this 24-hour news cycle world now where we're bombarded by information 24/7 on our phones, on our computers, on television, on radio, you might think that we're living through extraordinarily difficult times. What with the unrest in the Middle East and terrorism, the threat of terrorism, the slowing growth in China, the devaluation of their currency, stagnant wages, the widening gap between the haves and have-nots. All of that sounds extraordinary, is it? Are the pressures facing our economy today really that much worse than they were 50 years ago, 30 years ago, 25 years ago? Really?
Let's take China as an example. I think that is probably the most overblown concern in the global economy. And I don't mean to sound complacent about it or as though I've got my head in the sand here, but you know, China is not a real huge factor, particularly for the U.S. economy.
And yet the stock market reacts to it every time they have a hiccup over there.
Well,
they sneeze, the Dow drops.
And that's not completely uncommon. I mean, my start in this industry was I was in training in the summer of 1998 when Thailand devalued the baht. And you had this big disruption in currency markets. And it was supposed to be month-long training. And they after 2 weeks, they pulled us out, handing us a script and to go get on the phones and answer investor calls because everybody's freaking out because of this sell-off in Asia. And it ended up causing a 20% decline in the S&P 500 here in the U.S. But what effect did it have on the U.S. economy? None. What was when you look back on 99 and 2000, those are some of your best years of stock market performance. The economy was firing on all cylinders. So I think it's not unusual for U.S. financial markets to overreact to some of these international scares.
How much of the economy is on that grand scale, the world scale, versus the local scale? I mean, if all politics is local, does the economy and the ripple effect on the economy begin at the local level? If you have poor neighborhoods and bad schools, et cetera, does it ripple up?
I mean, it goes both ways, really, right? I mean, so we have this kind of national story, and so I agree. We've seen a lot of volatility in the market, and there's been lots of international news. But why is it so different right now than maybe other international mm-hmm. news? And the reality is, China shouldn't be affecting us as much as it is in the market. But I do think we're at this kind of point where, if you think about investors and they're thinking about where to put their money, and there's really not any great options right now. Everyone thinks the stock market's really high. Everyone thinks the housing market's gotten pretty high. So we're seeing, I think, just lots of people kind of moving back and forth, and that's adding to that volatility. Mm. Locally, I think we do see that a lot of people are affected kind of by local policies. So we can see a national policy or national changes that affect the locally, but it can be amplified or reduced based on what the locality does.
Later on in the program, I want to talk about some tax changes that are taking place here in North Carolina and what effect that may have on our economy and on Absolutely. People's fortunes here or lack of fortunes. The Fed has decided to keep interest rates where they are at the moment, and they're near zero. They have very little wiggle room. The fact that they're not raising them is good news for people who want to borrow money, bad news for people who want to earn interest on their savings, probably bad news for banks. But it leaves the Fed very little wiggle room if something should go terribly wrong in the economy. But when it looked as though the Fed was going to raise rates, the stock market reacted negatively to that. Then when they decided not to raise rates, the stock market reacted negatively to that.
Right.
So talk about this. you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
I think they probably had a free look and an opportunity to just get it over with and begin. And you know, I'm not an equity market strategist. I don't know what stock markets are going to do. But I have a hunch that once they finally get going on this, I think there will almost be a relief rally on Wall Street when people realize that by going from zero to, you know, something slightly higher than zero, the sky doesn't fall. And, you know, I think when you look at the members of the consensus, all the various economists who forecast what the Fed's going to do, and you see this dichotomy, this divergence of views. You had people saying they're going to cut, they're not going to cut. Some people are saying they're going to go back to quantitative easing. And in my view, I think the hallmark of good central banking is a good transmission mechanism to markets, a clear expectation of what you're going to do and then kind of delivering on that. And, you know, by my reckoning, when there's that much variety of opinion around your next step, it's no wonder financial markets are reacting negatively. They don't know what's coming next.
Should they have raised interest rates? Is it time or is it not time? Because, as you say, we look at the economy and we're kind of coming toward the end of this maybe, and it's still not exactly
sure
as strong as we hoped.
Well, so the Fed has two jobs. First of all, you know, since the Federal Reserve Act in 1912 or 1913, whenever it was, that created the Federal Reserve and said, your job is to keep low and stable inflation. That's what most central banks around the world have. In the late 70s, they added the second mandate, which is full employment. And that's never really been clearly defined. But so you've got two jobs, inflation and stable employment. And I think that the employment mandate, they're there. You know, unemployment rate's at 5.1%. Your job growth is pretty strong. I concede Steve's comment on wage growth being weak in the cycle, but you know, the economy in general is labor market in general is strong.
This
enough.
Is kind of off the topic, but it just popped into my head. Given the fact that the Fed's job is to keep inflation low, when President Ford was in office, I remember everybody walking around wearing those win buttons, whip inflation now, because inflation was horrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why was that?
Because you had the wage price spikes in that period, we were a lot more manufacturing centric economy in those years. In 1979, one out of five workers in the U.S. economy worked in a blue collar job in manufacturing. Today, that figure is less than one in 10. Mm-hmm. But what would happen is you'd have a recession come along and they'd, you know, lay everybody off at the factory. They'd scale back production. They'd cut down to one shift a day. And then things would get better. It'd improve. They'd blow the whistle. Everybody'd come back into the factory and you'd have, you know, these huge swings. And that contributed to a lot of volatility in prices.
So,
and
what's happened to fix that?
Well,
just in time production, computers?
All of those things, I think, play a role in stabilizing the economic cycle. You know, I think the central banks around the world would like to congratulate themselves for having played a role in that, and I wouldn't deprive them of some degree of that.
Okay. When they raise interest rates, and they will, well, is it liable to be a small increase? Is it liable to be a series month after month of small increases one after the other? And what will the impact of that be on people who buy cars, on people who need to buy houses, on people who need to take out home equity loans, whatever it may be?
I mean, in general, I mean, our inflation is very low right now, right? So, you know, I agree. So if we see a little increase, I don't think it's going to be a big difference. It's going to be a small. It's going to be just a nudge up. As the policy changes. And I think there is some need to give the Fed a little more flexibility in policy if we somehow see the economy start to downturn again.
It's Dr. Stephen Billings, who's Associate Professor of Economics and Co-Director of the Childress Klein Center for Real Estate at UNC Charlotte. Tim Quinlan is with us as well, Vice President and Economist with Wells Fargo Securities. We've got to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and communities in schools investing in Charlotte's future by collaborating with corporate, faith, and community partners to help students stay in school and achieve in life. Details at cischarlotte.org. And Children's Theater of Charlotte presenting Elephant and Piggies, We Are in a Play, based on the children's book series by Mo Willems. Saturday through October the 11th. Tickets available online at ctcharlotte.org. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Carl Bernstein and political satirist P.J. O'Rourke are here in Charlotte this week. It's part of their A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the White House tour. Bernstein's been writing seriously about politics since Watergate. O'Rourke has spent years providing his own twisted take, and they're speaking together in front of an invited audience, which you can hear on tonight at 7 o'clock on our website. But you can also hear them when they join us tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, doctors and police warn there's a nationwide surge in crime and overdoses related to synthetic marijuana. The drugs can make users violent. A rebroadcast of our recent look at the health risks and challenges to law enforcement of synthetic drugs.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the economy and getting a little checkup on the state of the economy around the world and here in North Carolina with Tim Quinlan from Wells Fargo Securities and Dr. Stephen Buildings from UNC Charlotte. What are your thoughts about the local and state economy? As a resident, do you feel confident about our economic future? You can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE, or you can email us at WFAE, charlottetalks at WFAE.org. When you combine the slowdown of the economy in China and what's going on in Greece, the problems they've had in Greece over the last several years, and the economic union trying to, the European Union trying to deal with that, and then what's happening in Syria and all the immigrants flooding into Europe, is that likely to have an impact? Does that cause more economic uncertainty in this country, and should it?
Sure. So I'll kind of, if it's okay, I'll take that one at a time. I'll begin with China. China accounts for only about 7% of American exports, which represents less than 1% of the U.S. economy. Okay, well, that's just the economy. What about businesses? American multinationals derive only 2% of their net income from China. So we're really just not too terribly tied to China. How about Greece? You know, I don't think there's an economist that can confidently say for sure whether Greece is going to stay in the eurozone, whether they're going to ultimately default on this thing. You've got armies of PhDs at the IMF and the OECD, and they can't seem to agree on it. But I can tell you this. You add up all of the government debt of Greece, and it adds up to less than 400 billion euros. And that may sound like a large amount of money, but that's less than one-third the outstanding debt of Spain, which is around 1.2 trillion euros, and not nearly as big as Italy, which is more than 2 trillion. So and then finally the
– So why are they the bad guy?
Well, that's another show probably, but I guess my point is that they collectively are just not enough to move the dial for the U.S. economy. And the migrant situation, my gosh, my heart goes out to them, and these pictures are devastating. You know, if you want me to think like an economist about that, all I can tell you is as migrants come into Europe, it actually increases potential GDP for Europe.
Really?
I mean, let's put all the other stuff aside about immigration. You bring in more people and you have greater GDP. Now, there's externalities involved.
The Berlin Wall fell and East reunited with West, there were all kinds of economic problems in Germany because they had to bring the East up to the standards of the West. Now, you have all these hundreds of thousands of people who have no money whatsoever because they left everything behind, flooding into Europe, and they're trying to absorb these people. How does that help?
Well, I mean, there's absolutely going to be some culture shock and some, you know, problems adjusting. In the early years of these sorts of things, there are a major burden on social service providers. You've got to teach them English as a second, or whatever country as a second language. Get them job training. I mean, it's not an easy thing.
Long term, I mean, it usually ends up being very fruitful for the country. I mean, the U.S. has, you know, had many series of immigrants flow in that I think has done a lot of great things for the U.S. It's more of being patient about what that can mean. So, and as we saw with Germany's one of the strongest economies in Europe right now. And, you know, as they reunified, it took a while, but eventually it started really growing at a very fast rate.
Now, speaking of Europe versus the United States, during the recession, Stephen, a lot of people were doing a lot of hand-wringing over the fact that we were propping up General Motors and we were saving banks and
what's wrong with saving banks?
thank you, Tim. From bankruptcy. we spent and we loaned money in parts of Europe. They took a different path. They took an austerity path. Which decision proved to be the wiser?
I mean, at least, you know, if you read kind of the numbers, you know, look at what happened, it really feels like the U.S. made the right choice in the story. We've seen Europe has just not nearly recovered nearly as quickly or as strongly as the U.S. After, you know, this 2007, 2008 kind of meltdown. And so I think the austerity in Europe really caused a lot of problems because You know, I always say this. You know, the government can do a lot of damage if it is very kind of conservative in the bad times. And then also, even more so, has to be more responsible in the good times. So we're coming up on a time where it's a little bit stronger growth. We're a little better off. Our unemployment's down. This is the time when the government has to really kind of be – this is the time when they can be have this austerity. This is the time when we can deal with debt. This mm-hmm. is the time when we can start to address some of these other issues that are long-term problems. Investing in infrastructure and other things are, you know, part of that story where we'll have more remedy to do so. But, you know, when times are bad is not the time to be doing that.
We don't seem to have the will to invest in infrastructure in this country.
Right.
Why not?
You know, it's a long-term story. It's a short-term political cycle. You know, no one gets very excited about building a new bridge, building a new road. And these are very expensive projects. It's really hard to get people to think about, hey, this long-term is going to have this kind of, you know, maybe have a very large long-term benefit.
But at the state level, we've been growing, I think you say, at a slow – or maybe John Connett. I don't know which one of you is responsible for this. At the state level, we've been growing at a slow rate, but growing nonetheless. Would we grow at a faster rate if we were spending more on infrastructure, or would that just be robbing Peter to pay Paul?
Well, you know, it's what are you looking to – in essence, you know, thinking as economists, what am I trying to maximize right now? Like how much – you know, what's our economy look like now or this kind of longer-term outlook? You know, when you spend money on infrastructure, you do generate economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm hiring people to build the roads. I'm, you know, spending all these kind of architectures, engineers to help design buildings and design these different types of infrastructure. So these are going to cause right now, you know, economic activity. So that's going to have that benefit. Of course, we have, you know, we have to maybe finance it through debt. And so the question is that a good trade-off longer term? And that's the kind of question we need to ask. But it is politically very difficult to get the support for some of these large, expensive tickets.
So we've been growing here at a relatively slow rate, but growing nonetheless. How does that manifest itself in the daily lives of average people? How do we feel it? How do we know? Do we know? Do we feel it at all because it's so slow?
Right. I mean, I think – well,
it's an unanswerable question, isn't
yeah.
it?
I mean, you know, I, like I said, I think some of the consumer sentiment kind of stuff has seemed fairly strong, that people are feeling better about the economy.
Well, they're buying cars.
Yeah.
They're buying houses.
That's right. So I think that's a good sign. I mean, you know, if you wanted to – we can talk a little bit some about the housing elements of this, because I do think there's been some interesting kind of housing activity. We've seen the housing markets really kind of take off.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a lot of people really investing that side.
Is that a bubble or is that real?
So I in preparation, because I thought this is, I mean, you know, I run a real estate center. Of course I care about this. So I was looking at the numbers for housing here. And so I looked at, well, let's look at the national numbers in the Case-Shiller Index, which is probably one of our consistent measures of housing prices. And the Case-Shiller Index takes homes that sold more than once and looks at how much they appreciate between sales.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we go back to 2000, in between 2000 and 2007, if we look at like kind of the 20 largest cities in the U.S., we saw housing prices double, 100% increase. In Charlotte, over that same time period, we only saw 35%. So a huge difference in the appreciation we saw in Charlotte, nationally relative to Charlotte. Now let's look forward to right now. Charlotte is right at the peak housing prices in about 2006, 2007. So we're back right at the peak of housing in Charlotte.
Just prior to the recession.
Just prior to the recession.
Mm-hmm.
So most people think, oh, wow, that sounds like a housing bubble. And so not so much because of the fact that Charlotte never really had much of a bubble relative to other cities. Cities like Las Vegas, Phoenix, we saw huge bubbles. We saw huge amounts of increases. And nationally, they are not back at that level yet.
Okay.
So we are seeing kind of the housing prices kind of go back to some of these pre-recession levels, but they seem fairly reasonable. I looked at about 4% growth, or 4 to 5% growth in housing prices over the last 5 years.
So it's also seems to be a seller's market. There's not a lot of inventory of previously owned homes, and prices are higher than they've been, relatively speaking, in a long, long time. Do you see that as a long-term trend?
I think that, you know, part of the reason why you didn't have the home price appreciation in the prior cycle in Charlotte is because, you know, the guys at the permit office have never seen an application that they didn't approve. I mean, we were building houses like gangbusters. We were building, at the height of the prior cycle, more than 25,000 new homes a year in the Charlotte MSA. When the recession came, that slowed to about 5,000 homes. And now, 6 years later, the most recent print puts us at an annualized pace of just under 13,000. Mm-hmm. So what's normal? You know, how many we should be building? But part of the reason that you're talking about, Mike, that this has tightened up a little bit is because we finally chewed down some of that excess inventory. And if you've lived in Charlotte during those years, just think of all the darn signs that you would see in 2009 and 2010. And that's thinning out a little bit. These listings come out now and they're picked up pretty quickly. So and that's finally starting to underpin a little bit more confidence in builders.
Nationally and locally, is the housing market and how it's doing a leading indicator of the economy, or is it a lagging indicator of the economy? Do people buy houses and sell houses when they think things are good, or when they think things are bad? We've got to get out from under this thing.
I'd probably say it's a coincident indicator. So I can give you some specific answers. The Conference Board has its leading, coincident, and lagging indicators, and it uses housing in all of them. It uses building permits in the leading. It uses starts in the coincident, and it uses sales in the lagging. So I guess what you could say is housing plays a very integral role in the economy. I mean, we go from an annualized pace of home building in this country from 600,000 three or four years ago to almost 1 million today. That means you have almost twice as many bricklayers, roofers, electricians, and all these guys are spending money buying lunch out, and that has a multiplier effect in the real economy as well.
Tim Quillen's here from Wells Fargo. Dr. Stephen Billings here from UNC Charlotte's Bell College of Business. We asked a question social media-wise. What are your thoughts about the local and state economy? Here's what we're hearing from people. Dennis says, is the time it has taken for the recovery not in direct proportion to the depths of the recession? It appears that those complaining about the speed of the recovery have no idea how close we were to a second Great Depression. And to follow up, some economists say if the Obama stimulus had been doubled, the recovery time would have been cut in half. What do you think?
So as the first thing, is it a direct result of the severity of the recession? The answer is, Harry Truman would hate this answer, is yes and no. the decline, some of the steepest recessions we've had, we were back to pre-recession levels very, very quickly. The recessions in the early 80s, for example, you had not as big a decline as we had here, but very V-shaped recovery. The 2001 recession, very mild. But it took us a long time, actually, to get back to pre-recession levels of output, of employment, of manufacturing. So this cycle was kind of both. It was a very, very steep decline. So yes, you get a pass. It should take longer. But even with that, by about any metric, going off the previous peak, going off the trough, by about any measure, this has been an agonizingly slow economic recovery.
So the second part of the question was about President Obama's stimulus, for which he got a lot of criticism. And some say that if he had done twice as much, he would have cut the recovery time in half. Do you agree?
I mean, I think there's a lot of debate about that. And we just don't know the answer, right? There's no way. We don't have the experiment. I'm a researcher. I'd love to have a nice experiment. There's no way we know what the world looked like if we had doubled it. But it does seem, again, these parallels to Europe, it does seem that our stimulus was helpful relative to the more austerity type of situation in Europe. So based on that, it would seem to say that, yeah, if we spent a little bit more money, it might have had a little bit more kind of a quicker or larger or kind of recovery in the end.
I've got a slightly different take on it.
Okay.
I think Steve's right. It's kind of an unknowable thing, but we do get something kind of like a control experiment that we can do, and we can look at what Canada did. Because Canada actually had – I think that the problem with the infrastructure program as it was implemented in the United States was that it just wasn't – the money didn't get into the hands that it needed to quickly or effectively enough. To take President Obama's own description of it, some of those shovel-ready proposals weren't quite so shovel-ready after all.
Right.
In Canada – and it was maybe dumb luck on their part, but in the middle part of the last decade, they put together this program called Infrastructure Canada, which linked the federal government, the provincial government, the city government, altogether so that when there was a need to have fiscal spending to goose the economy, it could get into the hands that it needed to. even adjusted for the size of their economy, which is much smaller than ours, even adjusted for that, they had a much smaller stimulus program, but it was far more effective because it put people to work right away. I was driving in Boston yesterday and drove over a bridge and saw the inscription, 1937 and 1938, and it just reminded me of, the Works Progress Association, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and that boy, we really knew how to do infrastructure in those days.
Well, the TVA, it's all a product of the Great Depression and trying to get us out of it. Justin writes two words, wage growth. The guest is 100% on the nose with his comment. I'm not sure which one of you is talking about. Wage growth is the single greatest reason why the economy has not fully recovered. Stop talking about China. The Chinese markets are government-controlled and are not free markets that affect our economy compared to the complete lack of wage growth. What do you do about that? That's a private concern for the most part, isn't it?
Yeah,
wage growth? Unless you're working for the government.
One other thing about wage growth, just because I made that comment about wage growth earlier, is that it's not just – we're looking at – the number I gave was for just kind of the average person. But we've seen this real kind of heterogeneity or bifurcation – kind of this segmentation in wage growth. We've seen a lot of wage growth at the top. We've seen really no wage growth at all kind of at the bottom of the income distribution. So that is
– How long can that continue before it becomes a collapsing house of cards, a crippling effect on the economy?
I mean, there's been a lot of economists
in the 18th century.
What?
Ask the French in the 19th century.
Well, that's when the
riots
started, yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think we've seen lots of really good research coming out of people like Raj Chetty at Harvard and others that look at this idea of inequality.
Yeah.
And the question is, how far can it go before it really leads to maybe civil unrest of some kind, or it actually, does it have a drain on the economy overall?
Well, Henry Ford knew this. Henry Ford paid enough money to his workers so they could afford to buy the cars they were building on the assembly line. If he knew it, and that was 100 years ago. If he knew it, why don't we know it today? It makes complete sense. It's logical.
You know what? It does make a lot of sense. I think that you
– help me out here. If you're in a capitalist economy where you depend on people buying and selling goods, if you have a bunch of people who can't buy anything, how can you make money? So if you pay more to people so they can go out and buy more – doesn't that work?
Yeah, the problem is that they are still spending. In aggregate, you've had consumer spending growth, a top-line contributor to GDP throughout this entire cycle. Consumers kind of retrenched and hid under the bed for about 5 minutes after the recession. We saw the saving rate briefly spike to 6%, mm-hmm. and then it went right back down to its long-term norms being much lower.
Are these buyers leveraging themselves again?
No. As a matter of fact, we've done the opposite. We've gone from being really highly levered, really consumers had borrowed, you aggregate all the debt and look at it as a share of income, it climbed to 126% at the height of the bubble. Today, it's less than 100.
So if wages aren't rising and they're not buying on credit, how are they doing it?
Well, to be fair, wages are rising. They're just not rising as fast as they should be. We do have wage growth. It's just not nearly as strong as it's been in prior cycles. And the reason it's not growing, I think there's two explanations for why wage growth has been so weak. One is we tend to associate periods of strong income growth and strong wage growth with periods of strong productivity growth. You had a huge boom in productivity right after the Second World War. You had a boom in the late 90s that translated to stronger income gains. The productivity hasn't been there in the last
Well, wages week. May not be rising, but inflation isn't either, and maybe we don't need to raise wages. I'll get an answer to that horrible question when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Parsec Financial Wealth Management for individuals, businesses, and trust services. Details at ParsecFinancial.com or by phone at 704-334-0894. And Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, local businesses, churches, and organizations can host community blood drives to support local patients. With CBCC, every drop stays here, saving local lives. CBCC.us. Doctors and police warn there is a nationwide surge in crime and overdoses related to synthetic cannabinoids, the illegal street drugs that often make users violently psychotic. So in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, a discussion of the health risks. national trends and challenges to medical professionals and law enforcement. That's on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. Why don't you join our conversation? Search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, or email us, charlottetalks@wfae.org.
When you think Domino's Pizza, you think pizza. Fair enough. But try Tech Giant, too.
We believe by transaction counts that we are in the top five of e-commerce companies in the world.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the pizza emoji, and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the state of the economy, among many other things, here today with Tim Quinlan, who is a vice president and economist with Wells Fargo Securities, and Dr. Stephen Billings, associate professor of economics and co-director of the Childress Klein Center for Real Estate in the Belk College of Business at UNC Charlotte. All this branding going on here today. So we just said on the air that wages aren't rising as fast as they possibly should be, and yet inflation is relatively low. So in the face of low inflation, why should wages rise?
So in general, the wage growth we're talking about, we tend to talk about in real terms. So we're taking into account this inflation story. So you're right. It really does matter how it is, your nominal wage growth, so how much more you're actually getting paid in your paycheck relative to this inflation rate. It absolutely makes a difference. So we don't need to have as much of the actual amount of your wage increase in a given, you know, month, year, and so on. It doesn't have to be as large because inflation is low. So that is helpful in some ways.
And if you raise wages higher and higher, doesn't inflation have to happen in order to keep up? You have to – the companies that are paying you have got to charge more for their products.
Well, I'll say something that might be a little unpopular, but wages are a bribe. The reason that wage growth has been slow is, you know, the recession was god awful, and a lot of people lost their job. And if they didn't, they knew people who did, and it made people a little bit reluctant to jump or change or, you know, seek their entertainment elsewhere. And, you know, employers found that they didn't have to raise wages all that much. Profitability was still going up, and they were just able to direct it to other places rather than wages. When you typically see the unemployment rate get down, and we're only recently down to low 5% kind of numbers, then you start to see the quits rate pick up. And
that means people are willing to quit their job to
find
something.
That's exactly right. And that comes from a monthly survey called the Job Openings and Labor Turnover. And we've seen quits really taking off dramatically in the second half of this year. So people are only now finding the confidence. I'd ask you, Mike, if you're running a business and you've got people quitting, what would you do to stop it?
I guess I'd raise their salaries.
That's right. I mean, there's also lots of non-wage stuff going on. I mean, we saw during this last recession, we saw people working more hours. We saw a variety of other mechanisms that's not really going to show up in this data. So I think it is a lot more complicated picture. I do think the kind of two stories that listeners Tim was talking about, the story of productivity is an important one. And I do think that maybe we don't have this kind of big boost in productivity maybe we saw quite in the past. We also have the other story, which is, I think, changing too, is just the really kind of labor market power for workers. In the simplest sense, you could think of something like a union, which we know have kind of disappeared mostly in the U.S. But the question is, how much market power do workers have in their ability to kind of negotiate wages, and how competitive is that kind of environment for them?
Karen writes, it seems obvious to me that employers are still milking the fear of employees losing their jobs, so they continue to pay as little as possible in order to line their own pockets. Pure greed and taking advantage of the recession remnants. Is it up to the employees to move to hiring paying jobs in order to force wages up?
Well,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. They have to start quitting.
I think Karen's totally dialed into what we were just saying in the prior comment. That's absolutely okay. The case. That's what it will take. I mean, if people start voting with their feet, then businesses will.
So if it's greed on the part of employers, Bill writes, how does greed affect our overall economy? Is there an answer to that question?
That's a hard question. I mean, what do they mean by, you know, greed? You know, as economists, we think about you get the return on whatever factor production you're involved with.
Right. What did Gordon Gekko say? Greed, for lack of a better word,
well,
is good?
Let's talk about this guy. I can't think of his last name. It's a weird last name, like Sklar or something. The young 32-year-old hedge fund manager who somehow bought a pharmaceutical company.
And wanted to raise the price
of a certain pill from $17-some to $750 overnight, and he's catching hell for it. And maybe he should, maybe he shouldn't. Is he greedy?
I think I'm not going to get in trouble for answering this one with my – yes, he's greedy. You're going to do – that's – I mean, look, do pharmaceutical companies –
He said this is a capitalist economy and this will help healthcare.
All right. So he has a point. Okay. Now I'm not defending his decision, but there is a point to be made here that there needs to be really high rewards and really high incentives for creating the next drug that cures cancer, because if there's not, then the really sharp go-getter people will seek their entertainment in a different line of work. So – pharmaceutical companies do need to be able to sell their product.
I'm sorry to stop you, but do you think that's true in the world of science, that these people are motivated by money? Because the scientists discovering the cures are not the ones getting the money.
I am sure there are people out there that do this out of the goodness of their heart. But I know that the way to get the best people in any economy is to compensate them higher than anywhere else. I mean, there are people who, play football purely for the enjoyment and satisfaction of it. But those are not the guys that are going to throw a touchdown pass in the Super Bowl. Those are the guys that are going to be compensated obscene amounts of money. Now, that does not justify what this guy did. That was awful to go in and take something that people are already dependent on and jack up the price of it by such a ridiculously large amount. But there does need to be rewards for companies in providing these kinds of solutions to people's real life problems.
Right. I mean, it comes down to, as the market economy, yes, we need to have this compensation. Things like R&D are very kind of difficult because you have to give these kind of excessive property rights for people to actually do it. And when you give them those property rights, they can do pretty much whatever they want. And it's something inelastic, so people have to have these medicines, have to have these drugs. They're absolutely going to have to, they'll pay almost anything for them. So,
you're preying on misfortune.
Well, I'm not sure that's a completely fair way to characterize it, and I think this is an ongoing debate. I didn't prep on this topic, but there are rules that allow these pharmaceutical companies to sell their branded drugs for a limited amount of time, and then it has to be made available to generics and has to be made available to open competition. But I do think that a rewards incentive for coming up with something is good, but I completely also agree.
Yeah, but he didn't come up. He bought the company.
Oh, he's a god awful. I'm going to get in trouble if I proceed. What he did was wrong. We can all agree on that.
Right. But there's no generic. I mean, the issue is that there's not a good substitute for it, and that's where maybe some of the rules on how soon can we have these generic competition for, these pharmaceuticals. That's where the policy, where we might be able to make some change to address some of those issues.
Well, to completely change topics, Wells Fargo did an online survey with USA Today recently that concluded that 20% of North Carolinians feel optimistic about the economy. 20%. That seems low to me, but are they wise to feel that way, or are they the smart ones?
I think that consumer sentiment measures aren't always a perfect gauge of where an economy is headed. That you asked before about lagging and leading measures. Confidence does lead picks up in retail sales and some of those sorts of measures. When you look at North Carolina relative to the overall economy as a whole, Mike, it's more or less about the same. We talked before about how long it took to get jobs back. We lost all the jobs in the recession. It wasn't until March of last year. It was October of last year for North Carolina. We are today nationwide 2.8% above our pre-employment peak. In other words, we have almost 3% more jobs in the economy today than we did at our high watermark before. In North Carolina, that figure is only 2%. In Charlotte, that figure is 6%. We have 6% more jobs today than we did at our pre-recession peak. So I think people in the Charlotte, North Carolina area have a lot of reason to feel optimistic.
So because we are less optimistic in North Carolina than the rest of the country, according to your survey. In USA Today, 20%. Did they do the legwork? 20% of North Carolinians felt optimistic. 27% of people in the rest of the country did. 25% of Americans felt the economy was doing poorly. 35% of North North Carolinians felt that way. Is that because we're a predominantly rural state? And when you take out Wake County and Durham County, perhaps, and Mecklenburg County, where people are doing well, the rest of the state's not so much.
Yeah, I think there's a real urban-rural divide in this story. We are seeing, you know, people coming to Charlotte. I mean, and one of the numbers, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, just the if we look at what cities we expect to grow over the next 2 decades.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the top 10 cities that are – so based on a city being at least 500,000 to start with, two of the top 10 cities in terms of expected growth are Raleigh and Charlotte. So we're seeing just tremendous growth in our urban areas. Along with growth always comes kind of economic fortune at the local level. I mean, once you have people moving in, you have new housing being built, you have lots of kind of activity going on.
So given the fact that Raleigh and Charlotte are the economic engines of North Carolina, the things that have been going on in the legislature in this last year where they've been talking about moving monies to rural counties and taking it away from the urban centers, is that wise? Are they running the risk of killing or starving the engine?
I mean, they're fighting economic forces, right? I mean – there's no reason to, if we see more activity and more people moving to the urban areas, to then take away the kind of, in essence, public finance element and giving it to areas where they're losing population or there's less economic.
How do you help those areas? The excuse given was that they can't even afford to pay for their schools, so we need to take some money from Mecklenburg and Wake and some of the very well-off counties and give it to those people out there. And they do have a point. If you can't, you have to educate kids. And if you can't afford to do it, how do you do it? So is there a solution for those counties that aren't?
Yeah, I mean, traditionally there's been a number of kind of tax incentives, and you get a lot larger tax incentive if you locate in some of these rural or lower income counties. I mean, that's been going on for a while. And then recently I just saw that the NC State Senate was approving this job development investment grant kind of story. So there's these programs where you can use get some substantial amounts of monies as kind of tax incentives for these businesses to locate.
There seems to be two thoughts on incentives. In situations like that, people like incentives. In situations like where you're giving money to build an arena or a football stadium, not so much. And in North Carolina, I guess we feel this more in Charlotte and certainly in Wilmington, there was this burgeoning film community, people who built lives and lived in Charlotte and worked in television and movies and commercials. And then when they cut the incentives off at the legislative level, that went away. I mean, they've all moved to Georgia and South Carolina and other places where they're giving incentives. So do incentives in general work? Is there a return on investment? Is it unwise to stop incentives for things like this?
So this has been taken up in, you know, scholarly debates in the economic community where they've looked at film incentives in particular. And there are a number of examples around the country. Massachusetts did this for a while. Michigan did it for a while. We did. The New York Times ran kind of a description of what a lot of these studies concluded and referred to Atlanta in it as Yollywood. And, you know, the sort of the takeaway is these guys go where the incentives are. And, you know, there's a difficult to measure positive externality that comes as a result of, you know, people watching Homeland and seeing Charlotte on TV and thinking Charlotte's a cool place. Does that contribute to a faster population growth here? You can't prove that, but that's sort of.
Yeah, but it's a clean industry. So when you got people, yes, the people who are working in front of the camera are making a fortune, and probably they're not paying as much in income tax as they would if they actually lived here. But there's an ancillary ripple effect. You got to have set builders and painters and carpenters and costumers.
The literature says it comes out to be revenue neutral for the state and other.
How can that be when they suddenly up and disappear because they don't have any work? How can that be revenue neutral?
I think there's I think it's a mixed bag story. I mean, I can tell you lots of. I've read this literature a fair amount, and there's lots of stories of they get the incentives were so large, and the locality spent so much money that it really was was a revenue loss.
Well, what
and
about,
it wasn't worth it? But there's other cases where it really generated some kind of positive benefits, and that's typically been the case where you have a good mix of existing industry, other things that are amplified or increased by this new business.
What about more normal businesses, not Hollywood businesses, brick-and-mortar businesses, manufacturing businesses, et cetera, distribution businesses that we're losing to South Carolina?
Right. So I think in general, the ones, the businesses that we're losing in South Carolina will kind of are just going for the kind of cheapest place to do business. And that's not where at least Charlotte is right. probably going to have its comparative advantage. It's going to have a comparative advantage in businesses that want to locate in a city our size. So one of the things I always kind of think about is that Charlotte's not competing with, let's say, South Carolina. It's competing with places like, you know, like it's comparable cities. Some place like Nashville would be something similar. Or just kind of these medium-sized cities. Those are the cities that are really going to attract similar businesses as Charlotte.
And in the legislature, they've been toying with changing the tax code. In fact, they are changing the tax code to a certain degree. They're lowering individual income taxes, and they're going to depend more on the taxes on services like car repairs. And some say that impacts the poor more than it does the wealthy. How might that impact the overall economy, these changes? Or is it too soon to tell?
You know, I think a lot of these kind of stories on kind of tax stories, you know, you got to think about two ways. You know, if we have lower taxes, that's going to leave more money in people's pockets. So that's a good thing always. But when we have higher taxes, we have lots more money to spend on these other things like public goods, infrastructure, other things that might benefit lots of people.
And if you're trying to attract newcomers, which we obviously are, at least in Charlotte we are, you need to have infrastructure spending on roads and sewers and schools and things like that, don't you?
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of people always debate, oh, we need to give, you know, have really low taxes. That's the only way we get businesses. But the reality is if we always have low taxes, we don't have very good anything else that they like, that these businesses want. We don't have very good roads. We don't have very good schools. So you really can't kind of always be offering low taxes and expect to have then the other kind of elements, the infrastructure and so on, that they might like.
So are the two of you generally optimistic about the economy around the country and here locally, or are you guarded? Tim?
If you look at the top 10 Southeast cities.
Do it quickly.
Okay. 2010 to 2014. That's where we've got the population data through. Charlotte has the fastest rate of domestic migration. We're growing faster than Atlanta, Tampa, Orlando. I think I'm optimistic.
That's a good thing. Doctor?
Yeah, I believe I'm optimistic too. Consistently, like I said, the growth in Charlotte's great. I think we have a lot of good things. Google Fiber is a really great sign for it. Lots of other good indicators.
Dr. Stephen Billings, co-director of the Childress Client Center for Real Estate at UNC Charlotte. Tim Quinlan, vice president economist at the Wells Fargo.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and David Borax. The engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, archives, upcoming shows, and podcast, or to continue the conversation online, go to wfae.org/charlottetalks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Providence Day School, hosting an admissions open house Tuesday, October the 6th at 6:30 p.m. for grades transitional kindergarten through 5.